Well, good morning. I'm really sorry I did not make all the fun last night. I had a really bad headache, and so I retired to my bed early. I missed all the laughter and the ritual humiliation that the elders experienced. But, you know, that's a healthy thing. I know the elders might not appreciate that, but that sounds to me like a healthy thing when leadership is able to laugh at themselves and allow the people that they serve to humiliate them. It sounds all wrong, but somehow it's just all right. I was really grateful over breakfast this morning. I had two brief conversations. One was with Keith. Where's Keith? Keith's over here. Keith said to me, I asked him, did he enjoy last night? And he said, oh, it was a right laugh. And then I realized he was talking about, one of the things he was talking about was the talks yesterday. And he paid me the greatest compliment when he said, you're a bit like a comedian. And it was a compliment, but I was thinking that's probably not the most honoring thing about, God-honoring thing that I do. So I'm going to try and tone it down today. But thank you for that, Keith. And the other thing that struck me over breakfast, that's great when you share with people, I was talking to, is that the Wilsons, who've been married 61 years, they were telling me over breakfast. And look at them, and when they look at each other, there's a wee sparkle there going on, you know. I was a bit embarrassed. I felt I was kind of interrupting intimate time over breakfast. But, you know, it strikes me sometimes when folk have been together that long, you know, one of the things I would love to have done over these days, in fact, I was planning to do it at the beginning of the week, we were going to go into chapter 5 and chapter 5, 6 of Ephesians and think about husbands and wives and submitting to one another and children submitting to your parents and dads. Don't aggravate your kids. Anybody's dad annoy you? Look at that, universal. It's all right, even those who haven't put their hands up are thinking, yeah, I'm going to do it, but dad's watching me. And, we're going to go into that, and we're going to think about the workplace as well. That's just one of the things, the workplace, you know, slaves, obey your masters. Masters, treat your slaves well, and obey in submission to one another. And we're going to think a little bit about that. Well, that's for another day. I'm sure Colin and Clive might pick up on some of that, because we need good practical lessons. But, you know, the key in all of that is the kind of idea of submitting to one another. You find it in chapter 5, verse 21, before Paul starts talking about marriage, husbands and wives and so on. He just says this, submit to one another out of reverence for Christ. That's the key to Christian living, is to submit to one another. I was telling the Wilsons over breakfast that story about the couple who had been married a long time, 50 years or something, and somebody asked them, what was it that made your marriage so success? And the husband said, well, do you know, when we got married, we made a decision that I, as the husband, would make all the major decisions, and she, as the wife, would make all the minor decisions. We've been married 50 years, and I've never yet made a major decision. You know, there's a kind of compromise in relationship. There's a submitting to one another. It's that business of putting one another first. I saw Colin and Margaret giving each other a wee peck. Colin went to kind of say hello this morning and couldn't get in the door and wasn't to the room and stuff. It was just all. But, you know, you'll be back together tonight. But you persevered. You stuck in there. That's good. And then I heard, you know, I've been talking about relationships and the loving one another and looking after one another. And but people, you know, even on a weekend away, people can sometimes be a wee bit naughty. Don't know if you've picked up on this, but somebody came to me who will remain nameless this morning and said to me this. He said, Dave, could you go to person X and tell them what the reading is and get them to read, because they hate reading. And they'll get really wound up by this. Now, I suspected there was a motive behind this, and I think it was probably because that person, whose name I'm not going to say Clive, probably had a little bit of humiliation last night and was just having his own, getting his own back today, wasn't it, Clive? But Alison recognises that. And the good news for you, my brother, is that she forgives you. Ha, 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 ha. So where are we going to go today? Well, we're going to, thanks for reading for us, Mary. That was really useful. We're going to kind of focus in on that passage from Ephesians chapter 4, the second part of the chapter. So let's go there now. Let's open it up in front of us, have it before you. And we're going to think a little bit about what this business means of living as children of light. That's what it's headed. That's the heading in the New Living Translation. What does it mean for us to live as children of light? The passage begins like this. So I tell you and insist on it in the Lord that you must no longer live as the Gentiles do in the futility of their thinking. Don't live as the Gentiles do, because their thinking is futile. They are darkened in their understanding and separated from the life of God because of the ignorance that is in them due to the hardening of their hearts. Having lost all sensitivity, they've given themselves over to sensuality so as to indulge in every kind of impurity with a continual lust for more. Now, it's really hard, isn't it? It's really hard living in Kirkliston or Broxburn or South Queens Ferry or wherever you happen to live, because it's a den of iniquity. Have you realized that? You probably think, you know, when you, people come from a small town and you ask them, you know, what was that like? I come from a small town in Ayrshire, and when people ask me, what was it like? When I was younger, I used to say, it's boring. I don't know, do you see that? Do you feel that? Young people? No, all right. Please don't look at us and please don't talk to us. Don't involve us in this. We don't want, you're humiliating us. Stop it. Okay, so I'll try not to talk directly over in that direction. They're there, but I'm going to ignore you, all right? You feeling safer now? No, I'm just making it worse. I'm so sorry. Wherever we live, wherever we reside, we need to recognize the kind of spiritual context in which God has placed us. Now, here's the thing. The place that we live in, the people that surround us, our neighbors, we are called to love them, to love that place. For God so loved the world that he gave his only son. That's somewhere in the Bible. Where is it again? Come on. Yeah. You know, it's a key verse. God so loved the world. God loves the world. However, we need to be slightly careful. Now, if you've got a Bible with you, and I hope you have, if you flick over to the book of James, and you get this kind of picture of what the church is like. Now, you get this in Ephesians as well. You know, one of the things I love about the Bible is it's very real, and you keep getting all these words, which are not to people who are outside the church, it's to people in the church, and the church is pretty screwed. The church is full of people who are not perfect. Remember, we were thinking about this yesterday. The church is meant to be a place for people who are not yet perfect, okay? And you see this again in the letter of James. So if you turn to the letter of James chapter 4, it begins like this. What causes fights and quarrels among you? So in the church, there are fights and there are quarrels. Don't they come from your desires that battle within you? I want to win. I want to be right. When you fall out with your parents, or parents, you fall out with your children, it's because there's a battle going on for who is in the right. Your children are asserting their knowledge that you are wrong and they are right. Parents are asserting their awareness that they are right. My kids used to say to me, Dad, you don't know what it's like to be me. You don't know what it's like to be my age and to go through what I'm going through. Don't know if you've ever said anything like that or heard anything like that. I used to bite my tongue because I always wanted to say, you know, I know exactly what it's like to be you, because I was once your age and it was awful. Wrestling with all the stuff you have to wrestle with. And actually, I think it's even harder now, because you guys who are younger, you've got so many more choices than old people. Like Colin or Clive had when they were growing up. You know, life is, you have a lot of choices to make. You, those of us who are younger, it is much, much tougher, and there's a wrestling going on. So Those of us who are parents, we need to understand what our young people are wrestling with. So there's both the external pressure and the internal pressure from within, the desires that we want. Now notice this about the church, James 4. You want something, but you don't get it. I want it, I want it, I want it. What do you want for Christmas? What do you want for your birthday? I want this thing and I want it instantly. Delivered by Amazon Prime. You kill and you covet. Wow, what a church that must have been. You kill and you covet, but you cannot have what you want. You quarrel and you fight. You don't have because you do not ask God. When you ask, you don't receive because you ask with wrong motives that you may spend what you get on your pleasures. Now, you see, we live in a world where pleasure is what we live for. You know, it's one of the great gods. In fact, I think it is the great God that we worship. You know, it's a great problem for the church. You know, people are spending, you know, I'm busy, I'm getting too much on. And often, not often, sometimes, often, often, sometimes, often. What folk mean is, I want to go and have fun. I don't want to come to church and do stuff. And it's too much. I'm going to, you know, I've got a busy job. I want to relax. Now, the thing is, church should be a place where we get filled up and we are filled with joy and we do relationship and we learn and we draw near to God. So, you know, we shouldn't be making a drudge. We shouldn't just be making it a task. It should be something that equips people and helps people. But we spend a lot of our time, the world spends a lot of its time on pleasure. Now, when I was a boy a few years ago, you know, an exotic holiday was going to Blackpool. You ever been to Blackpool? I went to Blackpool a few years ago, just in a kind of going down memory lane. What a dump. But going to Blackpool was great. You know, the Pleasure Beach. Anyone ever been to Blackpool? You know, and the Pleasure Beach going on, it was a kind of great joy. Now, going to Blackpool, if your parents said to you, we're going to Blackpool for your holidays, you might be slightly disappointed. You know, people are used to traveling abroad or going to more exotic places. Pleasure is really important. We're sold it all the time in our television, on the radio, we're on through the internet. Receive pleasure. That's the thing that we're taught to worship. James goes on, you adulterous peoples, don't you know that friendship with the world is hatred towards God? Anyone who chooses to be a friend of the world becomes an enemy of God. So here's the thing. We're called to love the world, to love the community that we're in, love the people that are around us, but we have to be very, very careful that we're not simply friends. You know how when you're friends with someone, you do everything together? You spend time together. You know, if you're married, your best friend should be your spouse. If you don't know that, you should. You know, you want to spend time together. You want to hang out together. You want to be around one another. And you affect one another. You know, your attitudes to things has a huge kind of consequence. And when we're friends with the world rather than loving the world will have a great power over us to influence us, to go down the road, to think about things in the way that the world does. Now, you know, going back to Ephesians, Paul's trying to explain to them, this is how the world is. You know, the people that are around you, the Gentile people in Ephesus, you need to understand the spiritual predicament that they are in. They might be nice people. You love them and you care for them. They're wonderful people to spend time with. But you need to understand, if they are not followers of Jesus, they are living in a place of ignorance. He explains that quite clearly. He talks about things like confused thinking. They have confused thinking. They are hopelessly, the New Living Translation says, live no longer as the ungodly do, for they are hopelessly confused. They have darkened understanding. They are hard of heart. Now, this seems harsh to say it, but we sometimes forget that's the reality of the people that are around us. Now, we get a little examples of this. You know, I think in the last five years, there have been developments in our culture, in our nation, that we could never have predicted, that didn't see coming, that were a little bit unusual, and we've yet to work out quite how we handle it. Let me give you an example of this. So my youngest daughter, her name is Molly, is at Dundee, Duncan of Jordan. She's an artist, and she's studying there, and she lives in a beautiful townhouse, and on the day of the referendum, Brexit referendum,
the day after, I visited her in her flat and I met two of her flatmates. And these two flatmates are non-binary in terms of their sex. They don't want to be described as a male or a female. And it's really important. I guess at school you might be taught about some of this stuff. You know, might be people in school who are identifying like this. So you're not allowed to describe them as he or she. They happen to have been born girls, but they do not want to be described as that. And these two girls are non-binary, so they're neither male nor female, self-identifying, and they're in a relationship with one another. So that's a wee bit challenging, I find. Because I want to hear the story. And that day, actually, everybody in the house was really upset about Brexit. They weren't very happy about it. A lot of young people are not happy about that decision. So they wanted to talk to an adult who they could blame. an older person, because it was the older people that had voted, even though in Scotland, largely, we didn't vote for Brexit. Just being non-judgmental, but having to deal with that. You know, now, I can't say I'm terribly well thought out on this, because 5 years ago that was not a thing. You know, 5 years ago, if I even put that out there, you would have thought, maybe some of you still think I'm nuts. Like, is that a thing? He's talking about a thing? Is that really a thing? It's a thing, believe me. That's happening. It's happening in our schools. Our young people are learning about that and having to live with it. And of course, you've got to be welcoming and not say anything that's different about it. But it seems to me, and again, I'm saying this without having, done a huge think through of it. I'm kind of wrestling with it. But it seems to me there's the Bible witnesses to this. Male and female, he created them. That's how we were made. We were made as men and women, made precious in his sight, made in God's image. And so when we kind of struggle with that, when we say, no, I'm neither male nor female, it's probably a sign of the ultimate rebellion, not of just of individuals, but of our society. When our society simply says, yeah, okay, you be whatever you want to be. You identify as whatever you want to identify as, and that's okay. Now, okay, I'm not judging people, and I don't think we ought to. I think we've got to be patient and loving and kind with people who identify in that way, because we're all on a journey. We're all broken and confused. But what the Bible tells us, what Paul tells us in Ephesians is, this is what the world looks like. They are separated from the life of God. They're darkened in their understanding. They are ignorant, and their hearts are hardened. That's the reality of the world that we live in. It's the reality of the world that you're kind of growing up into if you're younger. And so you have to learn what it is to love people who are coming from that environment. Even though you go, oh, I'm not sure I agree with that or I like it. The easy thing to say, I don't think this is quite right. And to proclaim that. Now, I think this might be the case. I'm not sure, but I think just standing up and saying, this is ridiculous, writing the letters, dear BBC, I'm shocked by what's happening. That probably is not going to win people's hearts and minds. You've got to be alongside people, listening to them, loving on them, helping them to see that maybe there's a bigger picture. And you see, Paul's saying to the Ephesian Christians and the other churches that were involved, you have to learn how to operate in this culture. You have to be the ones that are the people that show the light of Christ. He goes on, verse 20. I'm just checking my time here. I think I've got 11 minutes I'm giving myself. Is that all right? Verse 20 goes on. You, however, did not come to know Christ that way. Surely you heard of him and were taught in him accordance with the truth that is in Jesus. You were taught with regard to your former way of self to put off your old self, which is being corrupted by its deceitful desires, to be made new in the attitude of your minds, and to put on the new self created to be like God in true righteousness and holiness. You see, he's saying to them, you need to be different from the world. If you're friends with the world, if you love the world so much that you're just like the world, nobody's going to see a difference. Why would people even bother with Jesus if they see no difference in you? And being friends in the world, it can be quite costly. Did I talk about, when I came in July, I can't remember if I told you, did I talk about the famous rock star I spent an evening with? Did I tell you this story, Emden, remember? No? A few years ago, it was 2008, actually, I went to a concert in Glasgow. And at this concert, it was a concert by Florence and the Machine. Anybody know Florence and the Machine? Are you familiar with her and her band? So it was the first time Florence and the Machine had played in Glasgow. She hadn't released an album yet. And my brother and I go to gigs together. And we picked up on one or two songs. We thought, she sounds quite good. We'll go along to see her. Wow, she was amazing. Just an amazing performer in this little gig, a place called Oran Mor, downstairs in the basement. Just absolutely stunning. And we were just wowed. And we went upstairs into the bar and had a drink of coffee. Because some of you are worrying about that. No, it was beer. Okay, so I confess it was beer. And it was my turn to go up and to order a drink. So I stood up, turned round, and was heading towards the bar. And the bar was kind of empty. And sitting at the bar was this young woman called Florence Welch, the lead singer of Florence the Machine. And I went through that kind of moment that you sometimes have when you see a famous person or somebody. And I kind of went, what am I going to do? Do I talk to her or do I just ignore her? You know, I'd be cool. And because otherwise, if I go up to her, I'm going to go, hello. You were quite good. So I thought, right, I'm going to chat to her. I'm going to talk to her. So she was actually sitting at the bar. And she's a beautiful woman. You know, she's got red hair. She's a stunning young woman. And she's sitting at the bar surveying everybody. And nobody was talking to her. I thought, this is a bit odd. You would have thought people would have been swarming around her. So I went up to the bar and stood next to her. And I said, look, I just want to thank you for tonight. It was a great concert. You've got a great gift. And she was really nice. And she said, oh, thank you so much. We got chatting and found out a little bit about her background and how she got to where she was and what she was hoping to achieve. And then she said to me, so, what do you do? And I'm going, thank you, Lord, for you have made it easy for me to introduce you. So I told her what I did. And she said, oh, are you allowed to come to things like this? And so we chatted and we talked, and she was open spiritually. She wanted to hear. She obviously had some Christian experience in the past, and she was kind of intrigued a little bit that an old guy who liked music would come along to one of her gigs. So, it was good to talk to her. I thought, well, Lord, use that conversation, bring Christians into her life as she's traveling, and as she gets more successful, she probably will gather people around her. And she's someone that I still pray for now. That's kind of loving the world, but I was a little bit concerned because it can go a bit pear-shaped on you when you kind of make those kind of connections because you can get too close and things can get misinterpreted. And a few weeks later, I told the church about this encounter. Of course, the church at this point had never heard of Florence and the Machine, and they're going, who's she? And big deal. I was talking to someone, a couple of folk yesterday about bands that I like, and I don't think there was only one band that we had in common. The rest of the bands, they didn't know who I was talking about, basically. I have a bit of obscure taste. Anyway, a few weeks after this, someone in the church came up to me and said, oh, Dave, that woman you were talking about was talking about you on the radio. I said, what? She said, yeah, she was talking about you on the radio, and she mentioned it. I said, what do you mean she was talking about me? She said, well, she was being interviewed by Dermot O'Leary. You know Dermot O'Leary? She was being interviewed by Dermot O'Leary, and in the interview, she mentioned you. And I said, but what did she say about me? And what was the context? I said, well, I don't really remember. I just heard her talk. I knew it was you she was talking about. I went, all right. So I thought, iPlayer is my friend. So that night, went home and switched on iPlayer and listened to Dermot O'Leary's show. And there was Florence. And Dermot's saying to her, oh, you've had a great tour. It's been very great. You've got the album coming out and things. And you've met some interesting people on this tour, haven't you? And she said, oh, yeah, it's been great. People have been really kind. And Dermot then says to her, yeah, I understand that you met a vicar in Glasgow called Dave. Yeah. And I was really excited, you know, goodness, it's my 15 minutes, sorry, 30 seconds of fame. And then Dermot O'Leary said this, yeah, you met this vicar in Glasgow called Dave, and you spent the night with him. Now, I've got to say at this point, as an old man, the kind of fleshly bit of me went, yeah, if I was a younger man, that would be a story to tell. But anyway, I was totally embarrassed. And the great thing was, Florence Welch turned around and laughed, clearly thinking that was never, ever on her radar, which was great. But and she said, no, he was just lovely and listened to me. And it was just great to meet someone who was interested in what I was doing, who came from that kind of background. But, you know, it struck me when we're friends with the world and we go out to stuff, it can so easily appear that we're doing the wrong thing, or it can be misinterpreted, or it can backfire on us. We can get it wrong. Now, we need to be careful about that because, you know, if we're worried about how things could go wrong or how things might be perceived, then the church would never have existed. You know, the church had to reach out and it had to take risks. And sometimes, you know, that will be perceived in a way that maybe not everybody's going to accept or find easy. We need to be risk takers, but we also need to be slightly wary and careful about how it might be interpreted. And I was very, very nervous. I thought, blimey, if anybody in the church has heard this, what are they going to think? Am I going to have to give a disclaimer? I have not spent any time other than that 45 minutes, hour chatting and listening at a bar in public with Florence Welch. It could have gone all horribly wrong. So we need to be careful about our interactions with the world. We're called to be people who are sober and careful. We're called to be people who love the world. Now, having said all of that, I want to kind of bring it back to what it means for us not to be affected or infected by worldly values and the attitudes of the world, but what it means for us to be wise followers of Jesus. How do we start acting like wise followers of Jesus? Verse 20 is the kind of, and onwards, that's what Paul is trying to encourage God's people to be. Start acting as if you really are a follower of Jesus, not a follower of the world, but a follower of Jesus. Everything you do needs to be affected and steeped in him. He needs to be your desire. It's interesting, isn't it? What is it you most want in life? What's the most important thing to you? Going back to the whole idea of, about marriage, you know, when Paul goes from here and goes into marriage, Paul's got a passion for marriage, actually, and I think his kind of focus is Jesus throughout this book. Remember when I started yesterday? His focus is on keeping Jesus at the heart. And actually, when marriages are going to work, if both of you are keeping Jesus at the heart of your relationship, that sustains you through the good times and through the bad times. It's simple things that are actually costly things, like praying with one another, you know, sharing prayer. And I know it's slightly embarrassing to do this. I mean, I have had the opportunity, you know, because I've got a second chance, a new start. And it was really, really important right at the start for both of us that we prayed with one another. When we're apart from one another, we've got this little thing that we do every day that we're apart. It's a costly thing. I need to get it right. And I get up in the morning, I get out my mobile phone, and I'm doing my readings, and I send a text to my wife. Her name is Ali. I send a text to her with some Bible verses on it that I've been reading. So if she's away doing her work, she's an academic, it takes her away sometimes, or I'm away doing stuff like this. I try to do that. We make connection, but we're not just saying, hello, how are you, slept okay, but just here's a word that I've been thinking about this morning that I think might be for you. And there's something in there about pointing, keeping Jesus at the heart of our relationship so that we're not just kind of, the thing that we want most together, the thing that we most desire, the person that we most desire, other than one another, is the Lord. We keep the Lord at the heart of our relationship. And you see, if you're doing that, when temptation comes your way or when things are a bit rocky, you know, when you're saying, Jesus, when you're worshiping Jesus, praying to the Lord together, it makes a huge, huge difference because you're looking at him and asking, Lord, help us through this. Keeping him at the heart, living as children of light. That's what God calls us to do. Ephesians goes on, therefore, each of you must put off falsehood and speak truthfully to his neighbor, for we are all members of one body. In your anger, do not sin. Do not let the sun go down while you're still angry, and do not give the devil a foothold. Now, often that verse is used, don't let the sun go down in your anger, in the context of marriage. You know, and it's a great lesson, isn't it? When you're angry with your spouse, don't go to bed angry. Because if you go to bed angry, you wake up angry. But it's not just in that context. It's every context. You fall out with a parent, don't go to bed angry. Try and sort it out. Try and talk to them. Dads, when you've aggravated your children, as you do. Any dads never aggravated their kids? You're shaking your head. You never aggravated? You must be a great dad. Okay. Don't go to bed angry with your kid. Try and sort it out if you possibly can. When the leadership of the church screws up, highly unlikely, I know. Just affirm them now. This is, yes, that won't happen, Dave. Don't get angry about it. Don't let your anger fester away. You're children of light. If you're children of light, you walk in the light and you say, you know, I'm not sure about that. Don't fall out with one another, but say, you can we talk about that? I have a meeting on Tuesday with one of our congregation members who went away on holiday, and they sent me an email before they went away on holiday. They were at a meeting that I was part of, a leadership meeting, and this person didn't like some of the things that were said, didn't like some of the decisions, and they sent me an email, quite an angry email. I love those. And you can tell. And they were quite upset and angry. And you said, I'm quite concerned about this. And I want a meeting when I come back from my holidays. And can you send me dates for the meeting? So I sent a couple of dates. And I got an email yesterday to say they're coming to see me on Tuesday. I have this thing when people do that. And they don't tell you. You ever notice that? People don't tell you what it is that's made them angry and what they want to talk about. So I said, if you could let me know your headings so that I can have them ready rather than just going. So, you know, that might be a little bit difficult. And because holidays have intervened and things, hopefully that things will have calmed down a little bit, but they might not have done. And, of course, what the devil loves to do, Lord Voldemort, is break up relationships, divide people from one another. And you know, as your church continues to grow, I bet you see that happening. People taking a pop at one another. Sort it out. Talk to one another. Listen to one another. Be patient. Be kind with one another. Do not let Lord Voldemort get a foothold. Don't let the devil get a foothold. He who has been stealing must steal no longer. You see, he goes into Ephesians 5 and starts talking about the importance of work and being committed to your work. Doing something useful with his own hands that he may have something to share with those in need. Again, it's a beautiful picture of the church, isn't it? This church is a brilliant church in Ephesus because it's got all sorts of people, including thieves. We love thieves in this. This is a church for thieves. You are welcome here, but we kind of like it when you stop thieving. It's probably quite a good thing. See the murder thing? Don't do that either. That's a bad thing, generally speaking. Murder and thieving, bad things. You know, you come to church, we try to stop that. You know, I went through a stage in my last church where we were always having handbags nicked and things. There were so many people, you know, coming in, you know, who were homeless and stuff. And it was just a fact of life. It was a good job we had a good insurance policy. Premiums went up every year. It was just a nightmare. But it's a good sign. If your church has got stealing going on, you've got the right kind of people in your congregation. Now, some of you are really worried. I'm not coming back and you're getting a bunch of thieves. But see, that's a picture of what the church should be like. But we're moving people. We're people of living as children of light. We're moving people from being murderers and thieves to being followers of Jesus. We don't just leave people where they are. The power of the gospel transforms us. Look at you. Look around you at all the people who are being transformed. Some of you have got a long, long way to go on that journey. But you'll get there. And then he says, don't let any unwholesome talk come out of your mouths, but only that which is for building people up. Now, you hear unwholesome talk, and we think that's about swearing. I used to love, I still love Father Ted. You ever watch Father Ted? And I love Father Ted because there's lots of swearing in it that's not swearing, because Irish people can say a four-letter word and it's not swearing, apparently, but it's exactly the same as swearing. And it's all these priests that say four-letter words. Some of you are wondering what I'm talking about now. You, young people, you're not aware of Father Ted, but anyway, ask an old person and I'll tell you about it. And we think about it's that kind of unwholesome talk. And it is. You know, we need to be careful about how we use language and so on, and be careful not to swear, not to take the Lord's name. My mother, before she was a Christian, my mother used to tell me off if I said, "Oh my God." My mum, who's not a Christian, who was quite good at swearing, but she would never take the Lord's name in vain. She would never say, "Oh my God," or take Jesus' name in vain. And she would give me a right row if I said either of those things. And I said, "But Mum, you swear." "But I never take the Lord's name in vain," she said. And that was the kind of product of her age, I guess. But it's more going on here than just that. It's actually unwholesome talk is about how we talk about one another and how we talk to one another. You know, we need to think before we speak. Like, you know that old thing about we've got 2 ears and one mouth? You know this? 2 ears, one mouth. The reason for that is you need to listen twice as much as you talk. And sometimes we need to think carefully about what we are saying to one another and about one another. Ask the question, does this build people up? Is this building up the church? What is helpful for building others up? Wouldn't it be great if we were submitting to one another and then we were in our business? You know, if you're in a workplace, you know, this is a key thing. If you're a boss in a workplace, if you're leading a team, are you a grumpy so-and-so who don't give a stuff about the people, just go on with your job? Or are you the person, the woman or the man that goes in and you see your job as encouraging your team and have words that are going to build up the people that you work with? You see, that would be being living as children of light. If you're known as being the grumpiest so-and-so, he goes to church. All the stories I could tell you, I don't have time to tell you the stories that I know of people who are good Christian folk but are disasters in their places of work. Don't be that person. Be people who are someone who build others up. That's, you know, for some of you, that's what God needs, is wanting to say to you today. Take that away with you and dwell on it when you go into work tomorrow. Are you going to be the person that builds people up, that people will see that you are living somewhat differently and might one day come to understand it's because you're a child of light? You're walking with Jesus. Build people up according to their needs, that it may benefit those who listen, and do that in church. What an amazing thing would it be on a Sunday, you gather on a Sunday morning and everyone's falling over one another to build one another up, to see that as your role. Everybody's job, you know, just as welcome as everyone's job, that's everyone's job too, to build up the other people that are in your fellowship, the youngest and the oldest. My phone is now ringing to say, "Shut up, David." Isn't it great technology? I've turned it off. One last thing. Can I go a bit longer? 2 minutes. All right, I'm going to stop there because I want to go into that last verse. We're going to move into communion time in a minute, because I want to wrap all this up by having the right focus. And the right focus is Jesus. You know, we've had this up when I've been speaking. We've had this up all the time. If anybody comes across one of these, you find one of them somewhere, buy it for me. I will give you money for it and send it to me through Colin or through Clive, because I would like to have one because I think it would be a great tool. Jesus came, died, was buried, rose again, and is coming again. He is our focus. You see, in Paul, having told them about what it means to live as children of light, he then reminds them again, as he does again and again and again, he brings the focus back to Jesus. You see, a church that is strong, a follower of Jesus that is strong, will keep on coming back to him, dwelling in him, marveling at him, being grateful again for the love that God has shown us. Verse 1 of chapter 2 of chapter 5 is like this: be imitators of God. Therefore, as dearly loved children. Now, again, remember that. You are dearly loved by your family, by your church family, but above all else, by God. Each person in your fellowship and indeed in your community is loved by God. They are dearly loved, but you are dearly loved. So imitate God and live a life of God. Why should you live a life of love? Because Christ loved us and gave himself up for us as a fragrant offering and a sacrifice to God so that we would be put right with him and walk in relationship with God forever. See, he is our focus. And as we move into our time of communion, it's a wonderful opportunity to maybe just begin again, to recommit ourselves to living as children of light. Because Jesus died for us, he makes that calling on our life. May God help us to walk with him and to enjoy what that means for us in our day-to-day life. Thank you for listening to me over the course of the weekend. I have appreciated it very, very much. It's been a joy to be with you, and I hope to be able to share with you again at some point. Thank you. Let's pray. Lord, help us to put on the things that you call us to put on, to be people who are full of life, love and life. Help us to put to death that which is sinful, and help us to love you, trust you, follow you, for we ask it in Jesus' name.